Hey, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago. It's Labor Day weekend. It's Monday. Happy Labor Day to everyone. Hope you're all enjoying the weekend and making the most out of it. We've got a lot to go over today. We've got a great, wonderful Dead show that we're going to share with you. Got some updates on things in the music world, some big updates on things in the cannabis world. So hopefully you'll share a little bit of your Labor Day weekend with us, or whenever you happen to turn on this episode of our podcast and check out what we have to say. We're featuring today the Grateful Dead from September 2nd, 1988, 36 years ago today at the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland. It was night one of a four-night run at the Cap Center to kick off the 1988 East Coast Fall Tour, and this is the way it all began.
And I showed him a picture of you. Said, pal, get to know her, you'll like her. Seemed like the least I could do. Cause when he's charging his chopper up and down your carpeted halls, you'll think me by contrast quite proper. Never mind, I stumble. Champagne from your booth for a taste of your elegant pride. Be going to hell in a bucket, babe. But at least I'm enjoying the ride. At least I'm enjoying the ride.
Here's what David Dodd had to say about Hell in a Bucket. The Bob Weir, John Barlow, Brent Midlet song directly references the biker scene, and I'm sure that somehow Barlow just wanted to put that element into the band's repertoire somehow. After all, there are plenty of outlaw elements sprinkled throughout the Dead songs. In the case of this song, though, the singer-narrator seems to be wishing a sorry fate on his erstwhile main squeeze, with the argument being that she once was a biker, charging up and down her halls on his chopper. She'll realize that the narrator was pretty good, at least by contrast. Hell in a Bucket appeared on In the Dark. It was released in July 1987. The song frequently featured as a show opener over the course of the next two-plus decades, although it wasn't used in that role until about a year after its first performance. Played 217 times, first played on May 13th, 1983 at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, and last played on June 30th, 1985 at Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. When In the Dark came out, we were now in the age of MTV and music videos, and there's a real fun music video for Hell in a Bucket that, if you have time, go on YouTube and check it out. Bob Weir is a little bit over the top in his acting, but my guess is that's exactly what they wanted out of him, and it's just kind of a funny one to see, with lots of motorcycles revving their engines, and you know, a couple of big mean-looking guys walking around, and Jerry mixed in there, and it was really a lot of fun. So I would definitely check it out. But Hell in a Bucket was one of those quote-unquote new songs, right? That came around more or less the same time as Touch of Grey, and as you know, they began to work themselves into the lineup on a regular basis. Within a few years, they were no longer the new songs. They were just songs that were out there and we were all listening to, and really just became part of the whole scene. And Hell in a Bucket was always a fun one. We've talked about the Mondegreen Police on a joyride for At Least I'm Enjoying the Ride. At the end of the day, a really solid Bobby tune that the Deadheads, I think, in my opinion, at least came to really appreciate. Now, this show, this was the first, as we said, of a four-night run at the Cap Center. They played, this show was a Friday night and then Saturday night. They took Sunday night off, and then they came back Monday and Tuesday on the 5th and the 6th. It turns out, of course, that Sunday the 4th, the day they took off, was my wedding. The Saturday night show was my rehearsal dinner, and they played a second encore. It was the first Electric Ripple. The final Electric Ripple and the final Grateful Dead Ripple. A memorable weekend for all except for my East Coast buddies. deadheads who were at my wedding and were bummed to have missed the Ripple, but life goes on, and the wedding was great. Still married 36 years later, very happily, and unfortunately, Jerry's gone, and there's no more Ripple opportunities, but it's just the way it is, as you'll hear when we get to Fish today, too, right? You can go to a billion shows, and you miss one show, and boom, that's when they bring the house down. But we are still, for the moment at least, focused on our Grateful Dead show from 36 years ago, and somewhere in the middle of the first set, they dropped this one. Out Jerry. Dire Wolf is a ballad by the Grateful Dead, released as the third track on their 1970 album Working Man's Dead. The lyrics were written by Robert Hunter after watching a film adaptation of The Hound of the Baskervilles. Now, when they play the song sometimes on the XM Grateful Dead station, for songs from Working Man's and American Beauty, they'll always have Bobby giving a quick little quote right before talking about the particular song they're about to play. It always makes me laugh because whenever they talk about Dire Wolf, Bobby's little shtick is talking about how Hunter must have, you know, woken up from a fever dream and sat down and scrawled out this song. And in fact, you know, if he was watching The Hound of the Baskervilles before, that might definitely feed right into that theory by Bobby. The music containing elements of country and folk was composed by Jerry on the same day. The song tells the story of a man who plays with cards with a dire wolf on a cold winter's night in Fenario. The lyrics have been variously interpreted. The piece became a staple of the Dead's performances and was played over 200 times between 69 and 1995. A few months before the release of their album Oxymox in 1969, Grateful Dead, lyricist Hunter, and his then partner, Christy Bourne, began sharing a house with Garcia, his wife, and his stepdaughter. Living in close proximity gave an impetus to their collaborative songwriting. Hunter and Garcia wound up writing every song on Oxymoxa. Sometime later, Hunter and Caroline Garcia spent an evening watching a film adaptation of The Hound of the Baskervilles. According to Grateful Dead historian Dennis McNally, Caroline later remarked that the hound was a dire wolf. However, according to Hunter himself, as quoted in the annotated Grateful Dead lyrics, he and Garcia were speculating about the identity of the hound in the story and came up with the idea that it may have been a dire wolf. Hunter wrote the lyrics the next morning based on what the images that the phrase conjured for him, and Garcia wrote the music to them later that same day. Now, the location named Fenario appears in the folk song The Bonnie Lass of Fife, including in the Grateful Dead's version of that song. It refers to a fictional location. A friend of the band members commented in an interview that it was the perfect name for a generic place because it was evocative and had four syllables. In contrast, music writer Buzz Poole speculated that they may be derived from Fenrir, a mythical Nordic wolf who was chained up by the gods. The phrase, "Don't murder me," repeated in the chorus, was a reference by Garcia to his experience driving around the San Francisco Bay Area at the time that the Zodiac Killer was active. So you get your inspiration from everywhere. The song did become a staple of the Grateful Dead's live performances. The electric version of the song was typically featured in the first set. According to Grateful Dead's 100 Essential Songs, Dire Wolf was played 229 times between 69 and 95 and was played every year except for 1975 when they took the year off. 63 of those performances were in the first 2 years after the song was written. In later years, the acoustic version of the piece became more common. The structured pace of the song did not change much over the years. It was sung most often by Garcia, although early versions featured Bob Weir on vocals. with Garcia playing the pedal steel guitar instead. Now, that would have been a lot of fun to see, but alas, every time we saw him, Garcia was singing, which was fine, but no pedal steel accompaniment. An All Music review of this version praised Garcia's sweet guitar playing as a great feature of the song. Its lyrics have led to being described as an essential Grateful Dead song by the commentators. 229 times played. It was first played on June 7th, 1969 at the Fillmore West. And unfortunately, I don't have right in front of me the date that it was last played, which is, I'm usually pretty good about that, so I don't know why I don't have that. Let's just see here if we can't get that for you really quick, thanks to the magic of something called the internet. But let's see here. No, well, you know what? I'll get it for you, everybody, when we cut to a break, and then during our next musical break, and then we'll talk about it in a little while. And now, in fact, we're going to jump off with our music news. And Dan, what do you got for us? George Thorogood of the Delaware Destroyers, one bourbon, one scotch, and one beer. A blues song written by Rudy Toombs, recorded by Amos Milburn in 1953. It's one of the several drinking songs recorded by Milburn in the early 1950s that placed in the top 10 of the Billboard R&B chart. Other artists released popular recordings of the song, including John Lee Hooker in 1966 and George Thorogood, most famously, in 1977. George Thorogood recorded One Bourbon, One Scotch, One Beer for his 1977 debut album, George Thorogood and the Destroyers. His version is a medley in which Hooker's version of this song is preceded by another Hooker song, House Rent Boogie, which serves as a backstory to explain the singer's situation. According to Hooker, Thorogood told me he was going to do that, and I said, okay, go ahead. Live recordings of the medley are included on Live, which came out in 1986, and 30th Anniversary Tour Live in 2004. The song was featured in the soundtrack to the professional wrestling video game WWE 2K18. Now, we're getting this because Dan just saw George Thorogood out in Colorado over the last week. And, you know, Dan's been getting to a lot of shows out there, a lot of great rockers coming through on reunion tours, and every now and then some good cover bands coming through. But it's always a great throwback to some tunes that we were all listening to way back in the day, high school, college. And it's always fun to hear that and kind of mix it in with the jam band stuff that we're otherwise so devoted to. And this was certainly one of them. The quick review on the show was that, if anything, he showed at 74 years of age that he can still put on an energetic 90-minute set and deliver the goods as always. The band Thorogood has in tow are no slouchers. Bassist Billy Blau and drummer Jeff Simon have been there since day one. Guitarist Jim Suler and saxophonist Buddy Leach joined in 99 and 2003, respectively. When a band has been together as long as these guys have, it creates a strong stability, and these cats don't miss a beat. The evening began with Rock Party, a song called from his 2006 release, The Hard Stuff. It appeared to be a celebration, as he did not waste a minute during his very brief 90-minute set. Cranking out his usual band of rock and boogie, he played many staples, such as One Bourbon, One Scotch, and One Beer, I Drink Alone, and the obligatory Bad to the Bone. A couple of tunes played that were welcomed with open arms, Get a Haircut, and the Them cover of Gloria. After many years of not playing with the gem of his catalog, Born to be Bad, it has now been anointed the show closer. It closed out this show with a perfect ending. Written by Thorogood in 1988, the song became the album title and perfectly summed up who George Thorogood is. He pointed out the fact that he's been coming to Colorado ever since 1978, as he explained how appreciative he was for his Beaver Creek fans. All one had to do was look at the smile across his face to see how much he enjoys doing what he does. The relationship between Thorogood and his fans is a special one. The majority of the audience were dancing in the aisles. Even those sitting down were still tapping their feet or bopping along to a grieve-making night such as this one. Now, We saw George Thorogood at a small bar in Ann Arbor, probably back in about 1982, maybe 83. I was first introduced to George Thorogood, though, in 1981, when we saw the Rolling Stones at JFK Stadium in Philadelphia, the opening show of their Start Me Up tour. And the openers were George Thorogood and Journey. And very interesting, because my experience, people who open for the Rolling Stones typically don't get great reaction, because everybody's there to see the Rolling Stones. But unless it's just another incredible band with a history similar to the Stones, and that's hard to conjure one up at the moment, you get all sorts of bands. We saw Iggy Pop, we saw others. And the Stones fans can be brutal, and they can boo you right off the stage. They want their Rolling Stones, and they don't want to sit around and listen to other stuff. George Thorogood and the Destroyers at that show played about 30-minute set and just got a great reaction from the crowd. Unbelievable reaction. Everybody loved them. They were really a great opening act to get everybody up on their feet and moving around on a rather warm day. With all sorts of stuff going on in our brains on that day, I was there with a good buddy Mikey, who was always instrumental in bringing us there, and he was the one who introduced me to George Thorogood, so appropriate. He was there, good buddy Dan was there, and H was there as well, had some other Ann Arbor folks with us, and we did a lot of fun things, made the afternoon more enjoyable. There's the story of H and the balloon that 40 years later, he's still seeing out there somewhere. And we all just smile and play along with him, because it was a fun moment, and we really enjoyed it. So George Thorogood is the guy who we have today leading us into our music news. And without much further ado, let's get to that music news and see what we have to talk about, because there is lots of good stuff going on here. So Steve Silberman passed away. He was a writer. He was better known almost as a science writer who championed autism rights. He was an ever so passionate Grateful Dead fan and a beloved member of the San Francisco community. And he passed away last week. He was 66 at the time he passed. So, excuse me. He was raised by left-leaning teachers in New York. He was married to Keith Carricker. And Mr. Carricker is the one who announced the passing of his partner, Mr. Silberman. The breadth of Silberman's knowledge and passions and the all-encompassing legacy he left behind is huge. Some may know him from Neurotribes, a deeply researched and also fiercely opinionated work. Others may be familiar with him from his writing for Wired and his work on the early days of the internet and its online gathering place, The Well. If you're a Deadhead, you recognize his name from the liner notes of Dead albums, his co-production credited on the box set of So Many Roads, or Skeleton Key, the Grateful Dead dictionary he co-wrote with David Schenck. He was also a huge devotee and follower of David Crosby, and chronicled many of the aspects of Crosby's life. So that Crosby and the Dead were his kind of counterculture musical passions. He also has been doing a lot of must-read and must-retweet social media posts about politics and the state of the country and the Republican Party with his "Aw, So Cute," he wrote this summer, accompanying a photo of a less-than-full rally by GOP candidates he loathed so much. Trump's ally in Asheville tonight is like a miniature dollhouse version of one of Kamala's rallies. "Don't worry, big guy. They'll love you with a prison chow line," he wrote. He also once wrote, "I was a suburban kid, the son of agnostic parents who believed in the healing of the world by political rather than by spiritual means." What connected his many interests was his affinity for underdogs and the misrepresented, whether it was the neurodivergent community, the gay community to which he proudly belonged, and in a way, Deadheads. From the start, Silberman was, he once said, raised to be sensitive to the plight of the oppressed. And in one interview, he said, "I am not equating homosexuality and autism. Autism is inherently disabling in ways that homosexuality is not. But I think that's why I was sensitive to the feelings of a group of people who are systemically bullied, tortured, and thrown into asylums." Silberman discovered the Dead and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young during his teen years, and both rock institutions became a soundtrack to his life. He had, as you said, a unique bond with Crosby, which started when a young Silberman saw him in concert in 73 in New Jersey. From that point, and hearing Laughing on If I Could Only Remember My Name album, Silberman became a true believer in Crosby's artistic aspirations and his overall weirdness. As it turns out, Silberman also did some of his best non-science writing on the dead, whether it was an exploration of their underreported gay fan base, the importance of the drum section of their concerts, how it signified both breakdown and renewal, and the world itself. If Deadheads were a tribe that sought collective experience, we were also an aggregation of loners who had learned how not to bruise each other's solitude, that place where our souls and the music communed, he wrote in 1995. If you were tripping, the music would pour forth celestial architecture, quicksilver glistening with might bees, sites, cities of light at the edge of a sea of chaos, monumental forms that could be partially recollected in tranquility and turned into designs in fabric or clay, golden sentences, streams of bits, and some nights the hair on the back of your neck would stand up, and as a presence came into the room, given the body of the magnificent sound systems. His first show was on July 27th, 1973, the day before the official start of the Summer Jam in Watkins Glen, big festival with the Allman Brothers that we've talked about. He said I was 14 years old, all on my own because my friend bailed on me at the last minute and relatively clueless. I was mostly there to see the Allman Brothers, and the Dead came out and played a wonderful set that included the legendary Soundcheck Jam that we ended up putting on the So Many Roads box set, a gorgeous suite of improvised music containing several themes they would never play before or after. I wish I could say I fully appreciated it at the time, but I would be lying. In truth, I was completely overwhelmed by being in the middle of a crowd of 600,000 people. I had been dosed multiple times by sipping from the Boda bags that everyone was passing around, and I really, really had to pee, but the Port of Sands might as well have been in an island nation away from where I was standing. Still, the experience stuck with me because I went to see the Dead at Roosevelt Stadium in New Jersey the following year, which turned out to be another all-time highlight in the band's 30-year career, and can be found on Dick's Picks Volume 31. During Phil's bass lead in Eyes of the World, this was still in the first set, mind you, I knew I had never heard music as beautiful, adventurous, and alive as this in my entire life. That was the moment I became a Deadhead, and I never stopped. There's just more and more. He talks about getting to work with Dick Lavatla, who was the original keeper of the vault when they put together the So Many Roads box with David Gans and Blair Jackson. Just getting to know all these guys, he says he loved Dick. He was hilarious. When he found a new jam that melted his brain into a tie-dye puddle, he'd call me up raving, "This is better than Beethoven." I miss the sound of that sweet, cranky man's voice, though David Lemieux and Jeffrey Norman are doing a great job of maintaining the tradition with Rhino releases of the Road Trips and Dave's Pick series, and some of their mammoth projects like the May 1977. When asked to point out his highlights for May 1977, Silverman said, "Since there are so many, I'll just mention one. Check out the Sugary from St. Paul on May 11th. In the middle of a fairly standard performance, Jerry gets excited and the whole band joins him. And suddenly, the Civic Center Arena lifts off the ground and heads for the stratosphere that it's all about." And a lot of musical magic happens in St. Paul with the Grateful Dead. Good buddy Dan doesn't really know about it that much because it's just a cry for help for him. And he doesn't always make it out, but those of us do love it. And then David Lemieux said he met Silverman in 1999 and said, "When I started working for the Grateful Dead, Steve Silverman was around a lot working on the So Many Roads box set throughout the summer. He was so kind, warm, and welcoming to me every time we saw each other. He was genuinely respectful, one of the brightest whites I've ever met over the past 25 years. His intelligence and generosity were unmatched. Steve, you will be missed by so many. Everyone who met you or corresponded with you loves you." And here's Steve's final word. "When I die, please don't say that I've crossed into the spirit realm, gone to the other side, moved on to a better place, rejoined my ancestors, or any of those comforting fables he posted recently. Just selfishly or selflessly use my own impermanence to wake up to your own." Steve was quite a man, quite a big member of the Grateful Dead community, and it's no doubt that this is truly a loss for everyone affiliated with the Grateful Dead and the community, and those of us who were lucky enough to have had an opportunity to read Steve. This is one of the reasons why I buy all the CDs that they offer, even though you can go online and get it, because I love getting those little booklets they put in there and reading all the different people who write synopsis and summaries of the show or the time or what was going on. And Steve Silverman's have always been among the finest. And so, it was an amazing career for Steve, and we send our condolences to his family, to his husband, and to all of the people out there who were readers of Steve, regardless of the field or the area in which they were choosing to follow him in. So once again, we have another vaunted member of the Grateful Dead family moving on to join Jerry and the Great Hereafter. And while it's comforting to know that they're all getting together someplace fun and having a gas, you know, for the rest of us, it's just we're aging ourselves, and we see all of this happening. And, you know, it's not just enough that Jerry's gone or that the dead are gone, but one by one, a lot of the people so closely associated with the whole scene are starting to go. And that's why guys like Steve Parrish have to be cherished. That's why going out to see Bobby and the drummers whenever you can, Phil, whenever he's still putting on a performance, we just can't take it for granted, because one day none of those guys are going to be around. Of course, one day none of us will be around. But while we're around and they're not around, is the time period that I'm worrying about. And so, you know, time marches on. And it does march on, because we left Fish at Mondegreen, and they've now just concluded their four-day annual Labor Day weekend fest at Dick's Sporting Goods in Commerce City, Colorado, just outside of the Denver area. And pretty amazing shows all in all. You know, a lot of standard stuff, but the Friday night show, August 30th, was one, especially the second set, that particularly stood out, but we'll run through that. And suffice it to say, Cool Cousin Susie was out there, even though she missed the festival, and I saw her husband Sky out there. They flip-flopped on Dick. Sky was home with the boys, and Susie was out there partying. And I have to tell you, based on part of the first set and the second set, Susie may have gotten the better end of the deal. The first set, this is on Friday, August 30th, they start out with Back on the Train, Wolfman's Brother, Hey Stranger, I'm not going to pronounce it right because I've never heard him play it, Guglia Papyrus, which is a song that they, according to the folks here, it was the first time played in over 105 shows. The last time it had been played was on July 22nd, 2022. So that certainly counts as a breakout. They played No Men in No Man's Land, Steam, Evolve, Strange Design for the first time in over 100 shows, and then closed out the set with Run Like an Antelope. The second set was a Larry Michigan set. They came out and they opened up with Chalk Dust Torture, which I love. Then they played Sand, which is one of my absolute favorite Fish tunes, Into Ruby Waves. We've talked about that. Any song that's going to be mentioned in My Granddaughter is just awesome. We love Ruby Waves. Into What's the Use, Into Possum, another one of my currently, and it looks like will be for a long time, favorite Fish tunes. Sand and Possum just rock, and I love it when they're up there jamming on that. And then they closed out the set with Everything's Right, but then, of course, they came back and played Fee. And Fee is a tune that I've been chasing forever, one of the first Fish tunes way, way back that I really locked in on. And just never been able to hear it. And then the second encore was You Enjoy Myself. So, you know, to me, that's overall about as strong of a Fish show as you can find. Certainly one fitting for an event, an occurrence as big as Dick's. You know, those of us who are at the festival are obviously a little disappointed to have missed the Guglia Papyrus, to have missed out on Fee. But, you know, that's the way it is. It was like going with the Grateful Dead. If you went to 11 shows, the song you were trying to see, they played on the 12th show. And although there would always be initial frustration, it just always, you know, made you even more determined to go out and see more shows, because, by God, I'm going to get that song someday. And I'm sure that if I go to enough shows, I'll get Fee. The other big one I'm chasing is their amazing cover of the Velvet Underground song Rock and Roll. And always looking to grab that one, too, whenever I can. The Guglia Papyrus, I have to say, is a tune I'm familiar with from listening to Fish and other shows and stuff like that. And certainly one I would like to catch someday, as long as they're playing it. But like I say, Fee and Rock and Roll are two big ones. Fee, they played. Rock and Roll did not get played over the weekend, which, you know, I never celebrate that other people didn't get to hear it. But at least I say to myself, well, that wasn't one song that after I saw nine shows this summer, you know, a few shows later, they start cranking it out. But, you know, good for them and good for everybody who was there. The Saturday night show was really fun as well. Just very solid. They broke out to start the second set, Love and Cup, which feels like it had not been played at all of this tour, at least not at any of the shows I was at. And I don't think any in the interim, because I was following the set list pretty carefully. And of course, you know, Love and Cup has become, it's a great tune for one of the greatest albums of all time, right? The Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street. It was never one of the best known tunes on that album, but certainly a fun tune on that album, coming somewhere right in the middle. And, you know, such an upbeat tempo and everything, always one that we would hear and enjoy. And then when I started hearing Fish do it, I thought that that was just very cool too. And Fish has done it so often, you know, that the Fish heads will say it's a song that Fish has kind of made its own, you know, not unlike the great Dead and Not Fade Away, which they had no hand in writing at all, but got played so often by them that a lot of people might be mistaken for thinking that it was in fact a Grateful Dead tune. But a great Love and Cup, and they did Cross-Eyed and Painless again. Love it when they get to the Talking Heads. We did see that at Mondo Green, so you know, I certainly can't complain about that one. It was wonderful. Always love Talking Heads, and they do such a great job on it. Their encore was Bug, which I finally got to see after chasing it forever. And then First Two, which is a great instrumental and a song that I definitely enjoy whenever it comes up. Seems typically, at least in my experience, to be like a set closer or a second encore, you know, the closer of the encores or something like that. And then last night, out of nowhere, they come out and they just start cranking and doing some great breakouts again. They opened with Dog Log, which was played for the first time since June 20th, 2012. 464 shows. You know, that is... that's a pretty significant breakout, in my opinion. You know, we were all excited when they played St. Stephen after a four-year layover. But, you know, this one is 12-year layover, 464 shows, and they cranked that out with a great Runaway Jim, The Moment Dance, my friend, Tube, Fluffhead, always great, Stash, then Life-Saving Gun, the second set, Prince Caspian, Set Your Soul Free, Tweezer, Light, A Life Beyond the Dream, The Howling, More, which I really like. All these songs I like. Character Zero, Slave to the Traffic Light. And then they come out and they do their encore. And, you know, when they do these encores, it's just actually always fun to see what they're going to do. So having played Tweefry was a given, but that was the second encore. The first encore was they pulled out Sabotage, a song by the American rap group the Beastie Boys. It was released by Grand Royal Records in January 1994 as the first single on their fourth studio album, Three Communication. The song features traditional rock instrumentation, turntable scratches, heavily distorted bass guitar riffs, and lead vocals by Ad Rock. A moderate commercial success, the song was notable for its video, directed by Spike Jonze. It was also nominated in five categories at the 1994 MTV Music Video Awards. In 2004, Rolling Stone magazine ranked Sabotage number 475 on their list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. In 2010, it was dropped to number 480. In a 2021 update, Rolling Stone re-ranked the song at number 245. In March 2005, Q Magazine placed it at number 46 on its list of the 100 greatest guitar tracks and was ranked number 19 on VH1's 100 greatest songs of the 90s list. Pitchfork Media included the song at number 39 on their top 200 tracks of the 90s. So an amazing tune, a great tune. You know, again, a tune that might at least be a little bit dated for a lot of the Deadheads today. I just know my son and his crew were mostly all 2 or 3 years old when that song came out. You know, but here they're taking it on as their own. Why? Because Fish is playing it. Fish has brought it back, and I'm not going to say that some of these folks weren't getting into the Beastie Boys on their own. I don't mean to imply that, but certainly for a lot of people, when you go to a show and all of a sudden you hear the song, you're like, wow, whose song is that? Oh, that's the Beastie. Who are the Beastie Boys? And then, boom, now you've been turned on to the whole Beastie Boys catalog. And, you know, they're a great musical group and a really great genre and something to really help balance out, you know, your musical knowledge. So, again, a song that would have been great to hear. Sorry we missed it at Mondo Green. Congrats to all the people at Commerce City at Dick's. Glad you guys got to see it, and maybe we'll feature it next week. It's just so recent, it happened last night, that there wasn't really very much we could do about trying to track it down. So sorry about that. But that's it for Fish now for a little while. This long summer tour where I picked out 9 shows, 3 at Alpine, 2 in St. Louis, 4 at Mondo Green. You know, finally comes to an end. And of course, all anybody could say is, when's the next tour? Are they going to do their traditional Halloween tour this year in Las Vegas? Run usually 3 or 4 nights, including Halloween, with either a musical costume, one of the other, an album that they've covered, or new albums that they've written specifically for the occasion. And if they play in Las Vegas, is it going to be at the Sphere, or is there somewhere else they're going to want to go and play this year? So right now, we'll sit back and we're waiting to hear what's going to come next. Of course, there'll be New Year's shows, I would imagine, in Madison Square Garden. And then next year, we start all over again. Fish in Mexico, summer tour, if there's going to be any festivals, there's always Dicks. I find it starting to come into my life to the point where I'm looking at my schedules around it and, recognizing that, hey, wait a second, this is all fun. And just as easily as I slipped into that whole dead mode, I could just as easily slip in to this mode as well. And that would always be a good thing. But as you'd like to think we all know, the musical world does not begin and end with Fish. So as much as I like to talk about that now, we do have to go on and recognize other things that are going on in the world of music. And this story that came out is kind of like, well, it's about damn time. And I don't mean to sound angry or bitter about it, but Neil Young has finally explained the Crazy Horse Tour cancellation. And he says he's promising to return back to the road at some point. So here's what we find out. And for this story, thank you to Stereo Gum and Danielle Chalosky, who wrote the article and created this content for us to pass along to you. In June, Neil Young canceled the rest of his summer tour with Crazy Horse and was replaced by Sting for next month's Bourbon and Beyond and Ohana festivals. Today, the rock legend offered an explanation in a Zoom for Neil Young archive members. He says, "I was doing great. We were moving all along. Everybody's loving the shows. Then I just woke up one morning on the bus and I said, I can't do this. I got to stop. It was like I felt sick and I thought of going on stage. My body was telling me, you got to stop. So I listened to my body." So then it gets into all the legal matters. You got this, you got that. People bought tickets. They did this, they did that. I understand that. What matters to me is the art of playing in the music. That's what matters. That's what people loved. That's what they come to see. But if that's not there, me going on is not happening. My body told me not to do it, but now I'm starting to feel like I could do it again, and that's a great feeling, he continued. Not all of Crazy Horse. This happened to a couple were not all the way back. Crazy Horse will be back, God, and will play more. He will be performing at Farm Aid on September 21st, and in the clip he also said that he'll perform gigs with guitarist Micah Nelson and the promise of the Real Rhythm Section drummer Anthony Lagerfo and bassist Corey McCormick. We haven't announced any shows yet, but they're mostly theaters that I played before, little theaters, and then I can play a little bit of acoustic and then have the band come out and play. They'll probably be on the East Coast and then going towards Michigan and then Ohio and then a few other ones. They won't be marathons. They won't be 2 hours and 10 minutes of blasting rock and roll like it was with Crazy Horse. So here's what I would say. First of all, I'm very, very happy that Neil Young is not ill with something more serious or potentially devastating. No bad diagnoses of anything here. It doesn't sound like he's dying. And, just on a personal level, that's a good thing. That's a wonderful thing. Certainly that was a concern of everyone over this period of time while we were waiting to find out exactly what happened with Neil and why that show was canceled literally an hour or 2 hours before showtime at the Lakefront Theater here in Chicago, Planetarium, Northerly Island, and literally 2 hours while we were over at Good Buddy H's, folks in from out of town and from everywhere, we all got the buzz on our phone, show canceled due to illness. Now, I will take issue with, I don't really know that illness and I woke up one morning saying, I can't do this, I got to stop, are the same thing. That to me sounds like he was kind of mentally breaking down a little bit, and it may be that he was feeling the effects of 2 hour plus shows that he had been doing up to that point. And yes, you got to listen to your body and all that. When you've got a stadium full of fans basically sitting around waiting for you to come on stage, you have to understand whether it's right or wrong. Folks are disappointed. Folks are wondering, hey, You know, why did you go so hard earlier on the tour? You know, maybe you should have been pacing yourself all along. So you could have gotten to this point. And quite honestly, if you woke up one morning on the bus and said, I can't do this, I got to stop. You know, then the big question, of course, for everyone is, why didn't the announcement come until, you know, 6 o'clock, either 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the evening for a show that was slated to start, I think, around 7:30. You know, when it caused the most maximum inconvenience for everybody around. You know, and I will give Neil the benefit of the doubt and say that, you know, I'm sure if he started to feel that way, he didn't want to immediately bail on the show. There's a lot of people out there who are very excited about seeing the show, and I'm sure he didn't want to disappoint fans. You know, then it finally at some point, it must have just gotten to where he knew he wasn't going to be able to play. So we're really sorry about that. All of his theater shows sound great, and I would see Neil anywhere. But I'm going to be very honest about this. In talking to Alex and a number of the other guys, we were going to the show with Carrie and others. We weren't going to see small theater, Neil. We were going to see big stage, big concert, big sound, blasting it out, Neil and Crazy Horse. And all those songs that they were just jamming out on, that we all wanted to hear so desperately, even if it was just going to be one last time, with Neil playing his songs the way they're meant to be played, the way that we all love it. And, you know, so whether or not, you know, he'll do more shows with Crazy Horse, whether or not they'll be that deep and electric and just making all that beautiful noise or not, I guess we still don't know the answer to that, but it didn't happen that night. And it's unfortunate that didn't happen. And it's this balance of, hey, Neil, we love you. Thank God you're not sick. And hey, Neil, what the fuck? You left us all hanging. But, you know, like I say, that is what it is. There's nothing any of us can do about it other than just be happy that Neil is okay and that he will be going out and he will be touring again. And then the rest of us will just have to privately grumble whenever we get together, you know, because we're bummed out that we missed it. But, you know, these things happen and we move on. And another musical story that we have today that I want to pass on is that this coming weekend, just a few days here on Saturday and Sunday, is the Miracle in Mundelein 2024. This is the second Miracle in Mundelein. That's Mundelein, Illinois, just north and west of the city. It's an unprecedented cannabis and outdoor concert experience taking place at the Rise Recreational Dispensary in Mundelein, Illinois on September 7th and 8th. Presented by Rhythm Premium Cannabis, Rise Dispensaries, Day Glow, and Deep Cut, this second annual outdoor festival allows legal on-site cannabis consumption. I missed it last year, unfortunately. We had a very close family wedding that we were attending, which was also a bummer because J-Rad was the musical guest, and certainly seeing J-Rad would have been something that I would have loved to have been able to do, but we enjoyed being at our good friend's wedding of their son, and my son, Jonathan, was at the first Miracle in Mundelein and gave me great feedback on it, but such that I knew I had to go this year. And so I'm going with Jonathan and his fiance Bella, and I'm going with my son Daniel and his good buddy AJ, and we're going to head up there, see friends, see clients, clients for me, of course, listen to some fun music, and enjoy open cannabis. And it's quite a lineup we're going to be seeing on September 7th. Steel Pulse is going to be one of the earlier groups playing that day. And, you know, they're a band from all the way back in the 1980s that I got turned on to a little bit in college and more thereafter. Good buddy Alex is a big Steel Pulse fan. And he happened to notice even before we did that they were playing on the bill. You know, really suggested that we make an opportunity to get out there and to hear them, which we're going to do. Also, Raekwon and GZA from Wu-Tang, they're going to be playing. And, you know, Wu-Tang is one of those bands that I can't say that I'm a big aficionado of rap or hip-hop, but I follow it a little bit. And being a big aficionado of vinyl and records, big aficionado meaning in my world, something that I'm very into and I'm very excited about. Not that people come to me as an expert on vinyl by any means. In fact, there's many people out there who I go to get to see to experts on vinyl, like Cousin Aline's husband Bill down in San Diego, who's got the most amazing vinyl collection I've ever seen. But nonetheless, my son Daniel is a big Wu-Tang fan, and so I've started listening to them a little bit more. Then it'll be exciting to see some of their members there. And then the the highlight of the evening is Wiz Khalifa coming out to perform. I've never seen Wiz Khalifa either. So I'm also very, very excited about that. So the Miracle in Mundelein should be a great event. It should be a lot of fun and something that'll be nice, you know, to, like I said, to be able to spend some time with my boys and the people in their lives that are important to them, as well as just a crowd of pro-cannabis, let's have fun types of folks. And I will be reporting on this next week, how my experience at the Miracle in Mundelein goes. And hopefully you'll all plan to tune in and listen as I lay that out for you. So always, always so much going on in the music world out there. And it's just nice to know and be able to catch up on it a little bit. But speaking of music and particularly great music, let's dive back in to our show here. From 36 years ago today, from the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland, two nights before my wedding, and they played this in the first set.
Lose with the truth, baby, it's your fine. Baby, I hope you don't get burned. When the smoke is clear, she said, that's what she said to me. Gonna wanna be to lay your hand and a little sympathy.
Althea, a beautiful song. When they released it in 1980 on their album Go to Heaven, it quickly became a favorite among the fans. A Hunter Garcia tune, his legendary lyrics were known for embedding multiple layers of meanings in the lyrics, and this song is no exception. Garcia's soulful voice brings Hunter's words to life, but it's the lyrics that leave listeners pondering. The name Althea itself is rooted in the Greek mythology. Althea was the queen of Calydon, whose actions led to her son's death, reflecting themes of fate and consequence. While the song doesn't explicitly connect to this myth, the allusion to your fire might be a subtle nod to Althea's tragic tale. Althea was performed live by the Grateful Dead 273 times, making it a staple in their repertoire. Dennis McNally, one of the Dead's chroniclers, his belief is that the band overplayed it in the early 80s. Fans cherish its live rendition. The song's adaptability and depth allowed it to grow with the listeners, much like a trusted pair of pants with a sturdy, elastic waistband. Now, as we said, it was played 273 times. It was first played on August 4th, 1979 at Oakland Civic Auditorium in Oakland, California, and it was last played on July 8th, 1995 at Soldier Field, and as I promised, Dire Wolf was last played on July 2nd, 1995 at Deer Creek Music Theater in Noblesville, Wisconsin. So, Althea, great tune. Always reminds me of my good buddy Tommy, who loved Althea. We know that it was John Mayer's favorite tune, and when he played it, he used to really like to rock it out. And just one of those tunes you never grew tired of hearing, partly because when Garcia was playing it, it was so special. And after that, anytime anybody else plays it, it's because it always reminds you of Garcia and how special it was when he was playing it. So a great version of Althea on that day, and everybody at this show, I think, just really rocking out and truly enjoying themselves out there in Maryland. And the folks that were at my wedding and missed it, you know, again, sorry about that, but hope you had a good time at the wedding. So now the Dead K's out the first set. We make our way to the start of the second set. And the start of the second set in a dead show, I think of as always being the most pivotal moment in a dead show. First set, depending on what they open with, can make a big difference in the show. Like we talked about them sometime once coming out and opening with Scarlet Fire in a show I saw in Chicago, or something else like that. But inevitably, it would then go back to becoming a first set, right? So you'd get Little Red Rooster and you'd get all those other tunes again, which we talk about loving, but, you know, not necessarily falling into that special category that you thought was happening because they opened the show with Scarlet Fire. But still, it was always fun to see it there. But without a doubt, the start of the second set, to me, could always be what makes or breaks a Grateful Dead concert. Because no matter how good the first set is, whether it's absolutely rocking, whether it was flat, whether it was a bunch of tunes you just heard recently, whether there was a few breakouts, it was always the second set. That's the time when whatever you took had finally kicked in and you were really ready to just let loose. You know, during set break, everybody was really getting pumped up and in the spirit, and the lights would go out, and they'd come out there, and we'd all just be standing on our tiptoes waiting to see where are they going to take us with the second set. And whenever it opened like this, we knew we were in for a good night. Everybody knows Scarlet Begonias, the Garcia Hunter tune that was released on From the Mars Hotel on July 24th, 1974. The group first performed the song live on March 23rd, 1974 at the Cow Palace in Daly City, California. And from that moment on, I think it just became a fan favorite. Now, it was always traditionally paired with Fire on the Mountain, but that didn't begin until 1977. Once Fire on the Mountain came out, Scarlet Begonias would most often be paired with it when played live, resulting in what would be nicknamed a Scarlet Fire string of songs, with the first iteration of this iconic pairing on February, March 18th, 1977 at Winterland in San Francisco. Prior to that time, Scarlet would just be played without Fire, and it could kind of show up anywhere, first set, second set. And I have to say, it's always strange listening to a concert when they play Scarlet without jumping into Fire. You know, that's just the way they would do it. So at that show in March 1877, with the first time they matched the two songs together, what was interesting about it was that they played the combo to close the first set. It was almost always a second set opener, right? And so to do it the first time as a first set closer must have been very interesting. But I think that's the way the Dead like to feature breakouts from time to time and just drop things in there and then, you know, give you all something to think about during the set break instead of taking it out and, you know, really cranking it out after that. I had to play this because the opening is just so special. It sends a message to the Deadheads. You see those opening, you hear those opening notes. They're very distinctive. There's no guessing at that point what they're playing. Everybody knows it. And it just lets you know that good things lay ahead. I think it's their best second set opener in their arsenal. There's few things I love more than a second set opener of Scarlet Fire. And, you know, there's just nothing I say like the reaction of the crowd when you hear those first few notes. It's a great, basically what it makes you think of is I'm about to get a great 25 minutes of grooving music and just wonderful for mind exercises you may be experiencing at the time. It's great for, you know, shaking out all of the muscle stiffness that may have set in, you know, during the set break when you're sitting down and you stand up and you got to stretch a little bit and they just crank into Scarlet Begonias and it just gets you going. And you know, by the time they make their way into Fire on the Mountain and then make their way out of Fire on the Mountain, you didn't always know what the boys were going to do after that. But at that point, you felt like they could just do anything. And we are on for this ride. And, you know, wake me up in an hour and a half when the set finally ends. Not because I'm sleeping during it, but because I'm so deeply into it that, you know, when it would finally end, you'd kind of just almost be wandering around, you know, in a daze. What did we just hear? What just happened? And, you know, that's the beauty of Scarlet Begonias and Fire on the Mountain. They played Scarlet 317 times. Fire, they only played 254 times. But again, there was about a three-year gap between the two tunes. So Scarlet was getting played quite a bit before Fire ever came along. And then there were times... Red Rocks in 1984 on the first night we saw them do Scarlet into At Least I'm Enjoying the Ride and Helena Bucket, and that was very, very strange and different. We had heard that they were doing something like that, but nevertheless when it happened, you know, it still kind of caught us a little bit off guard. Why aren't you going into Fire? But it was great fun to do that. There was other times when they would play Scarlet and, you know, one of the new songs, right? So Hell in a Bucket or whatever else it might be, and then into Fire and then into wherever else they were going to go. But a true traditional Scarlet Fire, nothing like it. And it was just great and something that we all love to see. We are now going to take a break from our concert here, and we're going to switch gears and go to talk about some marijuana news. And Dan, what do you have for us to start this off? Maybe not quite cannabis, but certainly a recreational drug, as that term is understood in American culture today. And it was written and recorded in 1976 by singer-songwriter J.J. Cale. The song was popularized by Eric Clapton after his version was released on the 1977 album Slowhand, which was the album of the summer for us after sophomore year of high school. J.J. Cale's version of Cocaine was a number one hit in New Zealand for a single week and became the seventh best-selling single of 1977. Now, we bring this song up today because another show that Dan just saw recently is a band called The Journeyman. When a tribute band is all in and gives it their all, it's almost as if you're seeing the actual artist live right in front of you. And that's exactly what Journeyman does. They are a tribute to Eric Clapton featuring Sean Haig. Perhaps it's just my assumption. This is a review of the show. Perhaps it's just my assumption as to the air of Sean is replicating, however, considering his choice of tunage, as well as his garb right down to his horn-rimmed glasses, one would easily believe that he was stepping out of the 1990s the Running on Faith tour. Starting us off with Lay Down Sally, Sean and his band featuring Dina Bach provided backing vocals, Brandon Stevens on six-string bass, Robert Monroe on keys, and Darius Peterson on the drums. They burned through some of Eric's greatest hits, including Forever Man, and After Midnight, playing nearly an hour before setting the guitar down and taking a 20-minute break. Excuse me. I've seen Eric in concert twice, And I missed Journeyman the first time they toured the area, so I told myself I'd make sure to be at their next performance. As a tribute artist is concerned, Mr. Haig leaves it all on the stage. Every note, tone, and little nuance that makes Eric Clapton, it's plain to see that Sean has more than replicated Clapton's style. He's cloned his personality, and that is what makes Journeyman the ultimate tribute artist. Well done, Sean. Well done. Now, I have not seen them. Dan saw this band and was raving about them. But, you know, you got to say there's cover bands and artists you can cover, and there's artists you can cover. You have to be a brave man to go out there and cover Eric Clapton, truly one of the great guitar heroes of our time, top five, all that kind of stuff. Just an amazing, talented, amazing artist, and really a unique style of playing guitar, something he was just always fun to hear. So hats off to the Journeyman and Sean for being able to pull that off. When you're making Dan Humiston happy, you know you're doing a good job. That's our lead into the marijuana news today. Now, marijuana news today is very interesting because we're seeing some stuff kind of go all over the place here. And let's start out. Thank you to Marijuana Moment again for providing the content for today's marijuana stories. We find that Donald Trump is supporting the Florida marijuana legalization ballot measure. He just wants to make sure that they ban public smoking. So he said this past week that he believes voters in his home state of Florida will approve a marijuana legalization initiative on the November ballot, arguing that someone should not be a criminal in Florida when this is legal in so many other states. Now, just stop right there. This may be the first time that I actually absolutely agree with Donald Trump. And, you know, I always find that a little bit disquieting because you never really know what his motivation is when he says something. But certainly that's impressive. And he added that the current policy ruins lives, wastes taxpayers' dollars, and puts people at risk of dying from cannabis tainted with fentanyl. Again, I agree with all that. I'm not so sure about the cannabis tainted with fentanyl that that's as big of an issue as he seems to think it is, but it's certainly an issue out there. And there's no doubt that when you have a legal marijuana market that's highly regulated and everything's inspected and tested before it can be sold, that, you know, the fact that you're getting clean cannabis, whether it's tainted with fentanyl or PCP or anything else that might be out there, is a good thing. The former president wants lawmakers in Florida to follow up on legalization if voters approve it. But he wants to pass a law banning public cannabis consumption. And Trump said in Florida, like so many other states that have already given their approval, personal amounts of marijuana will be legalized with Amendment 3. Whether people like it or not, this will happen through the approval of the voters, so it should be done correctly. We need the state legislature in Florida to responsibly create laws that prohibit the use of it in public spaces so that we do not smell marijuana everywhere we go like we do in many of the Democratic-run cities, he added. Now, that's just a little dig at Democratic-run cities, but I say going to any big city in this country today, maybe even ones in states that don't have legalized marijuana, and you smell people smoking marijuana. Sorry, Donald, I'm with you right up to that point, but that's not the thing. But then he goes right back into the good stuff at the same time. Someone should not be a criminal in Florida when this is legal in so many states. We do not need to ruin lives and taxpayers' dollars, arresting adults with personal amounts of it on them, and no one should grieve a loved one because they died from fentanyl-laced marijuana. Well, again, the first part of that is right on. I haven't heard of very many people dying from fentanyl-laced marijuana, but certainly I appreciate the sentiment that he's saying there, right, which is that we just have to be careful. And the importance of legal markets is that we know that we are not getting marijuana tainted in a way that, you know, drugs might be. Back in the day, it was PCP or angel dust that everybody was worried about smoking. And, you know, that's just the way it is. Of course, Florida Senator Joe Gruters, who's a Republican and a former state Republican Party chairman, was very excited about this. He says he's incredibly proud to have President Trump stand alongside us in our effort to end needless arrest and incarceration of adults for simple possession of marijuana and to give Floridians the same individual freedoms to choose safe, tested products that more than half the country already enjoy, he says. And he's promised to push legalization to ban public marijuana smoking if the voters approve. So, okay, look, this is just good stuff, right? We're talking about marijuana. We're talking about Donald Trump, you know, certainly starting to look into some of these issues and, quite frankly, doing it in a way that at least on the surface, indicates that maybe he does care about this a little bit. Those of us who also care about it, it's a pleasure to see it. You know, I'm not gonna slam Trump on this or say that his thoughts are hypocritical or, you know, anything like that. Because with Trump, most of the stuff that he says is self-centered and hypocritical. But nevertheless, you know, at least his position right now. Now, of course, the problem with Trump is you never know. Is he saying this just to get elected? And then as soon as he gets elected, he's going to turn around and clamp it down. We all thought there was a chance that Trump would legalize it in his first term because it's a money-making thing, which, you know, suits his needs, as well as the fact that it seemed like a great way to make inroads on capturing the vote, you know, of younger voters in their early 20s and you know, and around there, people who, for whom it's a very big issue, and they'd be great to see that it was finally legalized. Trump didn't do that. But at least he is now telling us that he is in favor of the Florida initiative. And quite frankly, I think that that's a very good thing. However, and this could only happen in the Republican Party, because the Republican Party, as you know, we've talked about the number of people in that party who have been opposed to legalization, who have been opposed to rescheduling, usually giving us no reasons at all. And one of those people is our good friend, Ron DeSantis, the Republican governor of the state of Florida. And he has now doubled down on his opposition campaign against a marijuana legalization initiative that will appear on the November ballot. A prominent conservative pollster is reminding his party that the issue enjoys sizable bipartisan support. And a fresh poll out of Florida shows the legalization measure passing by a comfortable margin. Now, DeSantis earlier caught flak from cannabis advocates and industry stakeholders after calling the proposed marijuana reform that Floridians will get a chance to decide on bad policy and even worse constitutional law. He also accused the major cannabis company, Trulieve, of financially supporting the legalization campaign so that it gets a constitutionally protected monopoly on the market, arguing that Amendment 3 was written by the company's CEO. This comes a week after DeSantis' efforts and Rivers feuded over the state legalization initiative, drawing attention to the anti-cannabis governor's position on home cultivation, which would not be legalized under the current reform. But overall polling, both nationally and at the state level, raised questions over the political thinking behind the governor's ongoing vocal opposition to cannabis reform. While not all surveys have shown the measure reaching the steep 60% threshold needed to enact a constitutional amendment at the ballot under Florida law, it has consistently proved popular among the majority of Floridians. And as you know, we have really given DeSantis a hard time on this, even though he has such popular support in his state, he's being a know-it-all. He's being I'm going to intrude into your life. He's being a big government is now going to step in, even though this is exactly what conservatives fight against. And he's going to push against this. And I can't think, quite frankly, of a more fun day on election day than watching what happens with this initiative. We already know that Trump and DeSantis just don't like each other. Trump was brutal on him while DeSantis was still trying to run for office. And DeSantis learned that he's not the biggest bully on the block. And I think was humbled a little bit by that. All sorts of things are happening in Florida right now where a lot of his anti-woke positions and stuff on what teachers can and cannot teach in school are getting challenged in courts, and he's losing all over the place because, again, this is, you know, the United States of America, and we do have something called the Constitution. And despite what folks like DeSantis and other hardcore Republicans like to think, the Constitution provides a lot of things that are just not really up for debate, you know, even though DeSantis likes to think they are. So a lot of his policies are just getting shot down right and left. But I love the fact that Donald Trump is taking a huge dig at him without bothering to call DeSantis out, but knowing that DeSantis, for whatever his reasons, is so opposed to something that the constituents of his state are so firmly in favor of. You know, and it maybe this is his hill he wants to die on now. I don't know. But it will be very interesting to see, you know, where this all comes out. And this, the overall support for the legalization, it could be more. Even listen to this in Florida. By age 18 to 34, 79% approve. 35 to 54, 71% approve. 55 and over, even 64% approve there. By party, Democrats 80% approve, Republicans 55% approve. That's not bad. That's still in the majority. And I think that there's many Republicans there who are saying no just because they hear guys like DeSantis and other people saying no, and maybe really don't know what's going on with it. I can't say for sure, but that's the sense I have. And then independents are 70% in favor of it. So the bottom line is that an overwhelming majority of citizens in this country, across all age groups, across all political identifiers, across any categories you can think of, support marijuana legalization. And why not? Because they're smart enough to understand that marijuana is no worse than alcohol, no worse than nicotine, no worse than caffeine. In fact, not as bad as any of them in terms of what it does to humans, what it does to lost work time, and what it does just across the board on any of the factors that we look at when trying to determine what substances are safe and what substances are not safe. And people who have smoked marijuana, for them, it's all kind of a, well, duh, of course it doesn't hurt you. Of course it's not bad unless, you know, you really sit around and smoke too much and get higher than your brain is capable of handling. But even in that situation, you go find a bed or a couch, you lie down, you turn down the lights, you know, you put on some soft music, you put on a TV show or something that you're comfortable with. If you have a friend, they sit with you and kind of talk you down through it. And then, you know, an hour or two later, the buzz, primary buzz kicks off and or ends, and you're on your way back. You know, like we said, marijuana is not for everybody, and that's true. But these aren't 100% numbers that are coming out, but they are an overwhelming majority percent of numbers. And in a country where everything else, almost every political issue is, you know, razor thin, the difference between 51.5% and 49.5% that support it, right? It puts you in a position where when you see a spread this large and such an overwhelming majority of positive people, it really makes you sit up and take notice that this is happening. And so, you know, guys like DeSantis and guys, other Republicans who we've listened to, especially the folks from Kansas and other states where it's so popular. And again, they want to be so patronizing to us and tell us, you don't really know what you're talking about. You don't really know what this means. If you did, you would never support it. Don't worry, folks. We know. We're your caretakers. And we're going to make sure that this bad marijuana doesn't come in your neighborhood. Fuck all these guys. Seriously. We don't need them. We don't want them. And they're very, very stupid. They don't have any understanding of the subject matter that they're talking about. And they're taking a position that appeals to them because it's more of a moral position, which has a much greater support in the Republican Party than it does in the Democratic Party in terms of being prohibitionists you know, things like that. You know, there may be Democrats who don't smoke marijuana, but they don't spend their lives running around telling everybody else who can or cannot smoke marijuana. So we just need politicians, particularly on the right, to stop this. We need them to start listening to what they're saying and listen to the people who they represent. And quite frankly, in this case, as odd as it may seem, listen to President Trump, for God's sakes, because at least on this issue, and at least for the moment, he's on the right side of history. So we'll give him credit for that and hope that all the rest of you will catch up with that and join in as well. Now, on the positive side of things, we move back to Illinois, and we find that Illinois officials announced last week that they are awarding $35 million in grants to 88 local organizations using funds generated from taxes on adult-use marijuana sales to support community reinvestment efforts. The funding is being offered through the state's Restore, Reinvest, and Renew program that was established under Illinois' 2019 legalization law. It requires 25% of cannabis tax revenue to support areas most harmed by the disproportionate damage caused by the war on drugs, the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority said. Illinois created the most equity-centric cannabis program in the nation, and the R3 program is a fundamental component of our state's legalization framework, Governor J.B. Pritzker, Democrat, who signed marijuana legalization into law, said in a press release. By funding smaller community organizations in areas harmed by years of disinvestment and excessive incarceration, we are taking enormous strides towards justice and expanding opportunities for all. Since launching the R3 program, Illinois has awarded over $244 million in marijuana revenue-funded grants to that end. For too many communities that have suffered from systemic injustice and a criminal legal system that unfairly targets marginalized groups, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton said, Illinois equity-focused cannabis Illinois' equity-focused cannabis reform is a step in addressing these issues. The I3 program not only provides funding, but also empowers local organizations to create safer, stronger communities, giving every Illinoisian the chance to thrive. Among the grant's recipients are the Kankakee County State Attorney's Office, Northern Illinois Recovery Community Organization, Boys and Girls Club of Lake County, Illinois Reliance for Reentry and Justice, the Salvation Army, and Volunteers of America of Illinois. And the group's also touting their initiative to innovate, I2I, which is meant to support smaller organizations in managing their grant funding. Capacity building is the key to equity, Executive Director Del Reese Adams said. I2I is a game changer for grassroots organizations with little to no grant management experience. For many of these organizations, the limited capacity for grant management and the lack of organizational infrastructure became barriers to providing initiative services that address the needs to their communities. So the importance of this, of course, is that with legal access and all this money being generated, it's just nice to see where this money is going and that some of it is actually being used for positive purposes. And quite frankly, this money that's going into these neighborhoods is light years ahead and above the idea of social equity with respect to ownership of licenses for cultivators or dispensary owners or manufacturers, because again, the overwhelming majority of those, notwithstanding the social equity program, continue to go to people who are not Black, who are not Hispanic. And that's just a fault on the part of the program and the way that it was set up and the way that they kind of continue to push it in the wrong direction, which almost guarantees that the number of licenses awarded to social equity people will never be anywhere near the percentage it should be. But, you know, if they're not going to help them that way, at least if they can turn around and pour money into their neighborhoods to help them and to help rebuild their neighborhoods and to help give everyone there a better chance, that would also be a very good thing and a very, very strong thing and something they would like to see. But, you know, hats off to Illinois. I do give them credit for this. This is a good thing overall. And it's moving things in the right direction, too, in terms of normalization and kind of extolling the benefits that a state can recognize from legal cannabis. So, you know, even if some of these groups or some of the people who are part of these groups are not cannabis people or never would have thought of cannabis, they're going to be getting huge financial reinvestment dollars. And so in that instance, we do have cannabis to thank, as well as the Illinois government, for doing something positive like this and moving everything in the right direction. Finally, on our marijuana news today, this is great, but maybe it shouldn't come as a surprise given what we're talking about, but the California State Senate has approved assembly passed bills allowing small marijuana growers to sell their products directly to consumers at state organized farmers markets and to legalize cannabis cafes in the state. Now, this is huge. If you're a small grower and you're trying to compete in the current California market, it's very, very difficult. There's so many licensed growers. There's so many unlicensed growers that it can be very, very difficult to maintain it, to get it down, to get it shipped, find processors or dispensaries that will buy it from you. And the temptation, of course, is always to want to go to the black market. And now what the state of California is doing is they're giving them an alternative to that. You can go to state-sponsored, state-organized farmers markets, and you can take your crop and you can just sell it legally. And on Tuesday, the senators voted 27-5 to advance the marijuana farmers markets measure from assembly members and also approve the cannabis cafe proposal from other Democratic assembly members. The former bill would also allow on-site cannabis consumption at approved events. If enacted, however, the law would not mean that small cultivators could freely market their products alongside other traditional vendors selling fruits and vegetables, unless there was local and state regulatory approval to sell marijuana at a specialized area. The bill cleared the assembly in late May with nearly unanimous support before moving to the Senate, where it passed through two committees. It will still need to go back to the assembly for concurrence on Senate amendments. Under the proposal, the Department of Cannabis Control would be authorized to issue a state temporary event license to a licensee authorizing on-site cannabis sales to and consumption by persons 21 years of age or older at certain venues expressly approved by local jurisdictions as specified in the bill. And that's just amazing. And, you know, hopefully that will all get passed, that will all get put into play, And, you know, I think it will be a really good thing if it does, and something that certainly we would like to see in every state that has marijuana legalized now, because it is a good thing. It's a good thing for the growers. It's a good thing for community members. You just cut out everybody, all the middlemen, all everybody. Now, there may be questions about the safety of that marijuana, meaning in terms of has it been tested for pesticides or anything else that might show up that might be potentially damaging or detrimental to users. And as we sit here, I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't know what the state is going to do about that. But nevertheless, you know, if these are all legacy growers, you know, we would have to see. But I certainly would be willing, for one, I think, to try out their samples at the farmers markets. And I imagine that a lot of people will, too. And hopefully this will lead to bigger and better things. Again, normalizing marijuana so that people who walk into a farmers market are ready to see something like this. It doesn't take them by surprise. It doesn't sour them on the experience or anything else. So overall, in marijuana news today, not bad. Even right up to President Trump throwing his support behind Florida's cannabis measure. Of course, we do have the Ron DeSantis's of the world, the sourpusses, who are always going to be just that. But hopefully in a relatively short period of time, their political peak will have come and passed, and we will be back to politicians who may not agree on all the issues, but do at least agree on things like what is true and what is not true, and, you know, what are the basic values underlying this country and things like that. But in the meantime, don't forget, everybody loves marijuana, even if they say they don't. Okay, back to our show of September 2nd, 1988 at the Cap Center. As we venture into the second set and kind of get past the space and drums, Bobby pulls out this Bob Dylan tune. Watchtower is a song written by American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan from his Ace Studio album, John Wesley Harding, which was released in 1967. The song was written by Dylan and produced by Bob Johnston. Its lyrics, which in its original version contain 12 lines, feature a conversation between a joker and a thief. The song has been subject to various interpretations. Some reviewers have noted that it echoes lines in the book of Isaiah, chapters 21, verses 5 through 9. Dylan has released several different live performances, and versions of the song are included on some of his subsequent greatest hits compilations. covered by numerous artists. The song is most strongly identified with the interpretation Jimi Hendrix recorded with the Jimi Hendrix Experience on their third studio album, Electric Ladyland, in 1968. The Hendrix version, released 6 months after Dylan's original recording, became a top 20 single in 1968, received a Grammy Hall of Fame Award in 2001, and was ranked 48th in Rolling Stone magazine's 500 Greatest Songs of All Time in 2004, 40th in the 2021 version. Dylan first played the song live in concert on the Bob Dylan and the Band 1974 tour, his first tour since 1966. His live performances have been influenced by the Hendrix covers to the extent that they've been called covers of a cover. Dylan has performed the song live more than any of his other ones, with over 2,250 recitals. Hendrix was a known Dylan fan. He even once cleared a dance floor by demanding that Blowin' in the Wind be played in a New York club. In a 1967 interview, Hendrix described Dylan's influence on his own songwriting, saying, "I could never write the kind of words he does," Hendrix said, "but he's helped me out in trying to write two or three words, because I've got 1,000 songs that will never be finished. I just lie around and write about two or three words, but now I have a little more confidence in trying to finish one." Hendrix acquired a copy of John Wesley Harding before the album's official release and instantly knew he had to cover one of the tracks. Initially, he was planning to record "I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine," but after further consideration chose "All Along the Watchtower." He claimed he had a natural gravitation towards that track. "The songs Dylan usually gave me are so close to me that I felt like I wrote them myself," he added. With "All Along the Watchtower," I had that feeling less than 2 months after Dylan's recording the original Hendrix was in the studio laying down his version. So that's pretty crazy. The Grateful Dead started playing it while touring with Dylan in the summer of 1987. And while not necessarily one of their greatest tours, Dylan not being as sharp as he might be, you know, on a night-by-night basis or in other tours, when they got to this tune, the crowd really responded. So much so that after the tour ended, the Dead just kept it in their repertoire and played it until the end of that section we recorded. It's far and away, one of my favorite parts, where they're just jamming it and jamming it and jamming it, leading into the "All Along the Watchtower" line and coming out of it. And such a great song. Jerry just really played it. Bobby with his rhythm guitar and his vocals really belting it out. Everybody else in the band, you get a couple of fill bombs along the way. And Watchtower was just always a great, great song to hear. A real fan favorite. They played it 118 times. It was first played on June 20th, 1987 at the Greek Theater out in Berkeley. And it was last played on June 22nd, 1995 at the Knickerbocker Arena in Albany, New York. A fun tune, loved by all. We're getting to the end of our time today. We have one more tune we're going to play for you in a minute, and I will get to that shortly. Just have a couple of quick shout outs I want to give. The first one is to my wife, who I am celebrating my 36th anniversary with in 2 days, coming up here on Wednesday, and also to good friends Harold and Robin, who are also September 4th wedding anniversaries. The next day on September 5th, my good buddy Johnny down in Atlanta having an anniversary with his lovely wife Allie. Birthday coming up this week to my son's fiance, Bella, whose actually birthday is today. So happy shout out birthday to Bella. And my sister-in-law's sister down in St. Louis, Jackie G, having a birthday. So we got to give her a shout out too. So lots going on this time of year, end of summer, kids getting ready to go back to school. The concert scene, Dix, is over. So everybody's figuring, where am I going to go get my next jam from? But it's a good point. We stop, we catch our breath. We look around a little bit. Before we know it, it'll be the middle of the fall. Fall tours for bands all over the place will be kicking in. We've got tickets to see Goose in the not-too-distant future. We've got tickets for J-Rad coming up in a couple of months. We're going up to Miracle in Mundelein. Anything else that happens to show up along the way that might be fun. And if it's live music, it's almost always guaranteed to be fun. So very, very excited about that. Thank you to Dan for not only getting us some good transition tunes today, but the stories behind them. That's always a fun part of our show. And as we leave, we're gonna leave today with Black Muddy River, which is a quote-unquote new song. We always considered to be, as for a new song, pretty decent. It was almost always played as an encore. It was a fan favorite in the Twin Cities, St. Louis, Memphis, and New Orleans that were all situated on or near the Mississippi River. Sometimes they would play it in those cities, and sometimes they would wait and play it until they were in the middle of nowhere with no river around for miles or miles. But that's just the Dead, and you just kind of accepted that and laughed at it and moved on. Towards the end, Jerry seemed to lose his enthusiasm for it. So, for example, when he rose to the occasion at the last show on July 9th, 1995, and belted out a version of So Many Roads for the Ages, his Black Muddy River encore left a lot to be desired. And really, the story goes that Phil decided right at that moment, as they were playing the last note, that they could not end the summer tour on such a low note. So he pushed the band back to go into Box of Rain, making that song the last one ever played in concert by the band, rather than Black Muddy River. And it made for a much nicer, you know, farewell, even though we didn't know it at the time, than a not very good version of Black Muddy River could have ever been. So, you know, props to Phil, because he changed the whole dynamic of the very last song ever played live in concert by the Grateful Dead. And it's too bad, because a few years before, Black Muddy River could have very well been a candidate for that, the way it was being played. But, you know, at the end, it wasn't so great. Now, this version that we're going to play you from 36 years ago today is a young one. It's very strong. Jerry's voice rings true, and you can hear the energy build up inside him as he belts out the final lines of the song, a song that sent all of those at the Cap Center out into the night longing for more without even knowing yet what awaited them the very next night when they were going to get that ripple. Some were there the next night, some were. That's the story of the Dead and touring, just like Fish waiting to play Fiat Dicks after we saw them all over the place. Right? Sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't. But anytime you get Black Muddy River, you know, at least before 95, and maybe even the first, second half of 94, you know, Jerry just really seemed to love it, as you'll hear in this version. The Dead played it 66 times. First played on December 15th, 1986 at Oakland Alameda County Coliseum. And the final time was July 9th, 1995 at Soldier Field, the penultimate final song of the Grateful Dead. Not really performed well on that day, but this version is great. Enjoy it. Thank you for listening. We'll look forward to talking to you next week and bringing you up to speed on all sorts of stuff. And as always, please enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Happy Labor Day.
I will walk alone by the Black Muddy River and sing me a song of my own. Black Muddy River, roll on forever. I don't care how deep the wind, if you got another side. Roll Muddy River, roll Muddy River.